Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My special guest tonight is award-winning writer Andrea Wolfe, and we're talking about her book, The Traveler, One Man's Epic Quest to Discover Our Shared Humanity. Andrea, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
This is a unique book, and we'll talk about it in which way in a second, but whatever brought you to write a biography of George Forster?
Well, it was really through my biography about Alexander von Humboldt, The Invention of Nature, because Alexander von Humboldt always said throughout his very long life that it had been George Forster who had been the inspiration for him to go on his own exploration to South America, but also that Forster's ideas on politics and nature guided his own thinking. So I became very curious about who's the man who influenced the great Alexander von Humboldt. And when I then read Forster's own words, I was absolutely drawn into this rather extraordinary life by his own voice, really.
Well, I was going to ask you about original source material. Is there a lot?
There is a lot. Thank God for that. there are thousands and thousands and thousands of letters that Forster himself wrote, but also thousands of letters that friends, family, and colleagues wrote to him. Then there is a rather huge amount of essays, reviews, and books that he wrote. Given that he died when he was 39, he leaves a huge, he leaves a lot of work behind. But it's really the letters that are so extraordinary because, I mean, I've done more than 20 years of research now about 18th century figures, and I've never encountered letters that have been so brutally honest with himself and with the wider world around him. So there's a directness and immediacy to Forster's letters that are very, very unusual. They have a kind of raw emotions on the paper that I've rarely encountered, and definitely not so many and so often. So it allowed me really to be in his head much more so than, for example, with Alexander von Humboldt, who writes much more about his scientific work rather than about his emotions. So it's an extraordinary treasure trove, really, those letters that we still have.
Now, it for me, reading as a reader, the book was really sort of split in two. There's this wonderful section, the first section, of Forster's travels and adventures in the South Pacific aboard the Endeavour with Captain Cook. He traveled around Antarctica and New Zealand. He was the assistant naturalist and draftsman aboard the Resolution. And then there's the sort of more political aspect in Europe after that. And he ends up being in Paris at probably the worst time to be in Paris. I mean, truly frightening time. What a unique person he was.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. If you think about it, it's such a short life, but he really defies the limitation of this short life. So he's 17 when he joins Captain Cook's incredible voyage around the world. He's only 20 when they return. So by the time he's 20, he has seen more of the world than most people will ever do. And he then is really celebrated across Europe as this young explorer who writes a very popular account of this voyage. So everybody wants to meet this young explorer. And then he becomes a public intellectual. He has these fallouts and fights with famous other thinkers like Immanuel Kant or Rousseau. And then he becomes a revolutionary himself. So when the French Revolution happens, he is so enraptured by this idea of a new society that's based on the idea of equality and freedom that he becomes the co-founder of the First Republic on German soil.
Yep.
And eventually gets, you know, pulled into this vortex and then ends up in exile, as you
said. It sort of sad. I found his ending to be both dramatic and terrifically sad.
It's a very tragic life, you know. And on the one hand, of course, it's this life of adventures and explorations and fame. But he ends up deeply unhappy. He ends up in Paris during the Reign of Terror, which is this kind of brutal time where thousands lose their heads on the guillotine. But he also ends up being separated from the woman he deeply, deeply loved.
Right.
He has this very unhappy marriage to a quite remarkable woman, Theresa Heine, who is the daughter of a celebrated scholar in Germany, and she is wild and free-spirited and incredibly strong-minded and smart, but she has this great love for books, but also for men, for other men. So she ends up with having affairs during this marriage, and George Foster accepts them because he's also, I mean, today he'd be called a feminist because he really believes in equal rights for men and women. He believes in the education of girls, and he accepts these affairs, but he ends up very, very unhappy because Therese leaves him, and she has two children with one of his friends. So it's a very sad and tragic life.
I would argue that the first half of it, when he's in the South Pacific, is idyllic. I mean, when you contrast him in Tahiti and then him in the Reign of Terror, I can't imagine a life that you had two such extremes. It was amazing.
Well, I wouldn't call it idyllic because he also spends months and months and months on a sailing ship in Antarctica, basically.
So
that was pretty miserable, sailing.
It was about as miserable as you could get, yeah.
Exactly, sailing amongst kind of icebergs and on a ship where there is absolutely no dry place, wearing woolen clothes that is, I mean, never dry and always cold, and where the rigging freezes stiff. It is just absolutely miserable. And he has this rather difficult and narcissistic father.
Let's pause there because I want to start with his childhood, okay?
Okay.
We're talking about the late 18th century. His first expedition, and he was 10 at the time, he was born near Gdansk in Poland, 1754, 27th of November. His father, from the get-go, is sort of a wild, obnoxious character who only gets more so as he goes on board the ship with his son.
Yes, his father, Reinhold, is certainly not a pleasant person. And I think George Foster had quite a difficult childhood because of that. His father is, well, to start with something positive, his father's urge for knowledge and adventure gives George Foster an extraordinary education that not a lot of other boys would get. But, and this is a big but, his father is narcissistic, volatile, hot-tempered. He falls out with friends and strangers alike. And young Georg basically does not have much of a choice in what he's doing. So when he's 10, his father takes him on this wild expedition through Russia, where other children sit in orderly rows at school. George Foster gallops with fierce Cossacks across the Russian steppes along the Volga River. It's the first time where he sees the destitute people living in poverty, and it's the first time that he sees the harsh reality of inequality and despotism. And these are themes that will occupy him for the rest of his life. And then his father falls out with Catherine the Great, as you do, and then ends up taking the 11-year-old boy to London, where the young boy becomes the family's breadwinner by translating popular and best-selling travel accounts. And then when he's 17, his father tells him, essentially, you're going to have to join me now as my assistant on Captain Cook's voyage. So George does not have any choice in that matter. So it is a it is a difficult relationship they have. And it will take George Foster until he's 23 to really escape from his father's dark shadow and leave England and kind of really start his own life.
We should take a moment and just talk about what happened to the rest of the family. He had a mother. He had siblings. Where were they during all of this?
The mother, poor Justina, we don't know much about her, but what we do know is that she must have been very, very, very patient. She has this really difficult husband who just disappears for very long periods of time. So when George and his father go to Russia, the mother is left behind, heavily pregnant, and with five other children to essentially fight for herself. So the father doesn't really send money home. So she ends up selling some of his valuable books to kind of feed the children. And then when Reinhold and George Foster end up in London, it takes another 2.5 years until the father says to his wife, now, come from Gdansk to London and bring the children. So she has to organize this whole move with six children by then. And then she arrives in London, and not that much later, her oldest son and her husband go on a voyage, which is so dangerous that it's really not very clear if they're going to come home alive again. So again, she's left to fight for herself and her six children. So, as I said, we don't know much about her, but she must have been quite a steely woman.
Now, Reinhold sort of got to go on this trip, which is a very prestigious trip, even though it was very dangerous, with Captain Cook and the Endeavour, is because he hooked up with the Royal Society in London. Could you just say a sentence or two about the Royal Society and how important it was to be connected through that?
Yeah, the Royal Society in London was, in effect, the scientific center of Great Britain, if not much of Europe. It was the oldest scientific society, and this was really where scientists, thinkers, philosophers met once a week on Thursday afternoons, and they came together to discuss their own discoveries and treatises, but also anything that other scientists would send in by letter. So this was really the place to be if you were a scientist. These were influential thinkers, and George Foster ended going there at the age of 16. So he had a wild education in that sense. So where other boys his age might have gone to university, he still had an education that was unbelievable, because every Thursday afternoon he would hear the greatest scientists of Britain talk about their discoveries.
Now, this Captain Cook's voyage, this is his second big voyage to the Pacific and the islands around there. What is he after? What is he looking for in this second voyage?
In the second voyage, he's looking for the fabled southern continent. Scientists at that time believed that there must be a southern continent to counterbalance the landmass of the northern hemisphere. So what Cook essentially did is he did a full circuit around Antarctica looking for this southern continent, which of course the British hoped would be a continent full of gold, silver, and useful plants to exploit. So this was very much a kind of imperial expedition, a colonial expedition. And as they were going south, trying to find the southern continent, they obviously couldn't stay in the kind of amongst the icebergs for years. So what they did is when the Antarctic winter approached, they would go up towards New Zealand and then Tahiti, Tonga, Easter Island to replenish their stores. And then they would have another attempt down to Antarctica. So this is the reason why they kind of zigzagged through the South Pacific and ended up in on a lot of South Pacific islands, where George Foster really became fascinated by the indigenous people. So for Foster, this is a voyage really of human interaction.
Right.
So as they encountered the islanders, he is interested in their culture. So he records their languages, he observes their customs, he describes their appearances, and he's an intuitive ethnographer. And his descriptions of Polynesian culture are to this day regarded as the best accounts of Polynesian culture before European contact.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is award-winning writer Andrea Wolfe, and we're talking about her book. It is it's a gripping yarn, as they say, The Traveler, One Man's Epic Quest to Discover Our Shared Humanity. Andrea, what was always amazing reading through your book is they would land on another island and there would be a different culture there. And for most of the crew, it was the typical colonial crap. they were treating these people who are there landing on their island, and they would treat them as subservient, if that. Yet he always was fascinated by who they were as people and treated them often as people that he was fascinated, almost as an equal part. It was unheard of at that time, especially from Britain.
Yes, he has an incredibly unusual and unbiased attitude. So this is the time when racism is deeply pervades kind of Western society. This is a time when other explorers see indigenous people as lesser or inferior beings. This is a time when explorers arrive at islands and just treat indigenous people like half humans, really. So George Foster has a very, very different attitude. So he believes that all humans are equal, and he approaches the indigenous people with an open mind that is very, very unusual for the time. So he sees that different people have different cultures, different value systems, and he refuses to use European morals as a framework to judge them. So he returns from this voyage with an unshakable belief in humanity and humankind, and with a belief that everyone is equal. And for me, and for the rest of his life, he really fights against white supremacy and against slavery, for example. And for me, his life is really the proof that it's always been a choice. So we tend to think that bigotry and racism was almost inevitable in the 18th century. That's just how people thought. But I think his life is the proof that it was a choice back then, just as much as it is a choice today. And it was not an unavoidable way of seeing the world, because this young man really proves this.
Was he influenced by writers or philosophers of the time in particular?
Later on, certainly, but he is very, very young when he goes on this voyage. So I think the greatest influence is really what he sees.
Huh.
So I give you an example, which really, for me, was quite important to understand. So when they arrive in New Zealand, so this is the very first landfall they do, and they arrive in Dusky Sound, which is the southern tip of the South Island, and the ship has just spent 4 months in Antarctica, so it's pretty damaged. The sails are just hanging down in rags. So Captain Cook sets up these workshops on the shore. So there's the carpenters and the sailmakers, and everybody's repairing the ship. And there's this kind of cacophony of sound, like hammering and sawing. And George Foster looks at this very much through the eyes of an Enlightenment thinker with all the racism, and says, look at this art and industry we bring to these savages. So 6 weeks later, they are in Queen Charlotte Sound, and he talks very, very, very differently. He suddenly talks about them as fellow humans.
Mm.
And this is because he spent time with them. And by spending time with the Maori, he realizes very, very quickly, within a very short few weeks, that these are fellow humans who have a value system, who have cultures, who have deities, who have beautiful carved tools. And he completely changes. And from that moment onwards, he talks about the indigenous people as equal human beings.
As you write in the book, you describe that he found kinship where others saw inferiority. Now, and he saw some extreme stuff. Like he witnessed cannibalism. And it's not like he thought that was great at all, but he had a much more nuanced approach to understanding it than the rest of the people on board the ship.
Exactly. So everybody was appalled and disgusted, and George Foster was also shocked by it.
Yep.
But he refused to simply see the Maoris as heartless barbarians. And he tried to understand what was the reason for this.
Right.
And then he said, well, in any case, Europeans were brutal too. Europeans might think that they are too civilized to be cannibals, but they, you know, kings and queens send out thousands of soldiers into war to be slaughtered brutally. So he compares what is going on, and he just tries to understand, and he says vice and virtue are relative concepts. So, for example, when everybody's annoyed about the Tahitians for taking knives and tools,
right,
and clothing, again, George Foster tries to understand and says, and has an almost instinctive understanding that the concept of property must be something different in Tahiti to Europe. So again, he's always trying to put everything into perspective and to not use European value systems as the framework through which to understand another nation.
Now, Andrea, we're almost out of time. We only have a minute or two left, but I want to, in the introduction, you write that you actually traveled a lot to some of these places that George Foster visited to try to get a sense of what it was like to be there. What places did you travel to?
Well, it's very important for me to really follow the footsteps of my protagonist.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's all in the name of research, but of course it's a lot of fun. So I traveled through Europe with 18th century maps and engravings, trying to work
wow.
out where he lived and where he worked. But I also went further afield to New Zealand and French Polynesia, because I really needed to see the places that he had gone in. And that it is incredibly important for me, at least, to put myself into their mindsets, to see the same landscapes, to feel, you know, the heat, the cold, whatever they kind of felt. But also there are moments which are very special. So, for example, when I went to Dusky Sound, which is this very, very remote fjord at the southern tip of the South Island of New Zealand. It's so remote that the landscape has essentially not changed very much since he went there, which is very rare, because normally we go to places where someone has been 250 years ago and it looks completely different, but not in that case. And we had to get a helicopter and a boat to get there. And the most exciting moment for me was really when we went to this small harbor, natural harbor, where the Resolution had anchored, and we found the tree that the crew had used as a gangway to the Resolution. It still grows there. It grows almost horizontally over the water. And we know that because the expedition artist William Hodges painted this scene. So those are moments when time and space really collide.
Oh, my God.
I don't know, some kind of fourth dimension opens up. And you feel very, very close to your protagonist. And it doesn't really make it into the book as such, but it is an important step to understand, but it's also important in order to describe the landscape. So the New Zealand forests are, they seem for European, they seem so prehistoric and different when you see kind of tree ferns kind of lacing the sky. And you just imagine, you know, how strange this must have been for George Foster 250 years ago. I could prepare myself with photographs and videos I could watch, but he didn't know at all what to expect.
And knew nothing about the people either, except for there only been, three other expeditions to these areas?
Captain Cook had been to New Zealand.
Right.
So there were some people on board the Resolution who had been there. But again, these were sailors who approached the Maori with, arrogance at best and brutal disgust at worst. So they were not, what we would call today an ethnographer, who approached another kind of people with an openness, as George Foster would later do.
We're completely out of time. We could talk about this book for years. There's a lot in this. By the way, there was another ship on this expedition too, and they kept getting separated all the time. This is a wild story. My guest tonight has been award-winning writer Andrea Wolf, and we've been talking about her book. I strongly recommend it. The Traveler, One Man's Epic Quest to Discover Our Shared Humanity. Andrea, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.